This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are Colin Jost and Michael Che, the anchors of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. They're also preparing to host the Emmys Monday night. And they're nominated, along with SNL's other writers, for Best Writing for a Variety Series. Last January, they became head writers of SNL. Jost had held that position once before, but gave it up after becoming an Update anchor. SNL's new season begins September 29th. Let's start with a clip from one of last season's final episodes. Here's Jost and Che on May 5th.
This Stormy Daniels payment has turned out to be the loudest hush money in history. And during his Kings of Dementia comedy tour, Giuliani also said that the hush money was, quote, funneled through a law firm. Dude, funneled is not typically a word innocent people use when talking about money. No one says, yeah, my grandma funneled me $5 in my birthday card.
Rudy Giuliani is claiming that President Trump only learned a week ago that he was reimbursing Michael Cohen's payment to Stormy Daniels in $35,000 installments. I have a couple questions. Like, what kind of billionaire pays for stuff in installments? You're the president of the United States. Why are you paying for sex like it's a Nordic track? And how did y'all land on $130,000? That's such an oddly specific number. I asked Stormy to come on Update and explain it, but her agent said no, because if she's seen on camera with a black guy, her price goes down.
Colin Jost, Michael Che, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your writing nomination and on hosting. Before we get to other things I want to talk with you about regarding the Emmys and SNL, you know, I'm thinking as we record this Wednesday afternoon East Coast time, it's earlier than that on the West Coast where you are, there's a hurricane, like a catastrophic hurricane heading toward the Carolinas. And that's something that you might have to, like, assuming the hurricane is anything like what they're saying it will be, that's something you'll probably have to address at the Emmys. And, you know, it's really awkward to have a celebration when people are suffering like that. So is that something you're thinking through? Like, how are you going to deal with it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it crossed my mind yesterday. I mean, you never really know what's going to happen leading up to a big event because you're planning it for so long, and then something could dominate the news that day. But when it's something that's a tragedy, again, we don't know exactly what's going to happen yet, but the biggest thing I think sometimes we face it at SNL is you want to show as much support as you can, and, you know, you want to use that moment to maybe just actually raise money for people who are there, because you have a mouthpiece to tell people, go online, give money. The people in that room have money generally, and, you know, you hope as you can make it a moment just even to get support for those people.
So the last time we spoke, Donald Trump was a presidential candidate. He wasn't the president. It was just like days before the election. So the first show after the election, Dave Chappelle hosted, Chris Rock made a guest appearance, A Tribe Called Quest were the music guests. These are all people with like strong political points of view. And instead of an opening sketch, the opening was Kate McKinnon dressed as Hillary at the piano singing Leonard Cohen's song Hallelujah. And she ended it by saying, I'm not giving up and neither should you. Can you take us behind the scenes a little bit and tell us what it was like after the president was elected, trying to figure out what the show, first show of post-election Trump era should be?
Well, the sort of like amazing move from Lauren was that he had offered him that date like at the end of that summer. So I think he just sensed that whatever was going to happen in the election was going to be this huge moment, and he wanted to make sure whoever the host was would be someone that could deal with that and who at that moment people in America wanted to hear from. And that's, I mean, Dave is basically the ideal person to do that. So he had the foresight to book that way in advance. And then that night, you know, the election night was insane because I assumed, like most people probably, that Hillary was going to win, and you were watching the results come in, and, you know, people were having all kinds of reactions around the office. It was very intense. and you're then trying to write comedy. And, you know, not everyone even attempted to write comedy. Some people, understandably, were very upset. And Dave was the perfect host at that moment, because the next day when we were there for the table read, you know, he was just like, the reason you're in comedy is to react to things that are going on and to make them funny, to find humor even in whatever is the weird, darkest things. You have to figure out how to still put on a comedy show, because that's why you're doing this. And I think that was just the right kind of motivation for everyone to try to put a show together by Saturday that was still a comedy show. And, you know, I think that was reflected in his monologue really well.
So you all watched the election results at the office?
Yeah, I mean, we were there. Tuesday night is our writing night, so we're basically there all night. You're mostly there all night until the table read, which is Wednesday afternoon. You kind of go straight through. So normally it would have been a later start than normal because you're watching election results roll in. But then it was even more delayed because people were processing what was happening. I mean, it was very shocking. Whatever you expected going in, I think it was still shocking.
So I'm asking some of these questions because you're head writers as well as update anchors. Who came up with the idea of Kate McKinnon as Hillary singing Hallelujah?
Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider and Kate had an idea of doing some kind of song. I forget what the original, I think they had a different song originally, but they had the idea of doing something in that vein. But I don't know if it was just Kate or if it was a whole group from the cast. I forget the original version or original origin of it. And then I know Lorne thought of Hallelujah because Leonard Cohen had just died that week or
that's right,
before.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
I forget the exact timing, and I think he just thought that might be a song that would be that would seem sort of doubly appropriate in some way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So getting back to Update, when you do Update on Saturday night, it's really Sunday morning on the East Coast, because by the time you're on, it's after midnight. Every late night comic has done bits on the week's news. And so, like, you're kind of like late to the game in that respect. So how do you find things that are going to feel fresh at the very, very end of the week or the very beginning of the new week?
Fortunately, there's not a lot of people that I think like me. So I never really have a problem with finding interesting takes, because I feel like when you kind of do your own thing, it's not going to bump. You know, if I have a thought and five other comedians have that same thought, then I feel like it's not even worth saying, you know.
What's an example of a joke that you can say that you feel like other comics can't? Can you think of one?
Nobody else is calling the president a cracker on national TV.
Yeah, that got you a lot of love.
Yeah, it sure did.
What kind of reaction were you expecting? Yeah, go ahead. No, I'm kind of being sarcastic. You got it from both sides for that.
Of course.
Yeah.
But that's to me, that's interesting. That's compelling TV.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, because there's a lot of people that felt that way and was probably thinking it as well. And I think there's a lot of people that understood where that emotion was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, it's the same with Kate at the piano. People watching it, some people liked it, some people didn't. But the thing is, you believe Kate felt that. And that's what makes it interesting. So it was honest. You know, it really came from her. It really came from a real place.
So
that week too, I was just remembering too, that week, I forget if we worked on it later in the week together, Jay, too, but the on election night too, then we woke up on after the next day, or like, you know, in our office, but Neil Brennan was there too, working on the show. He's a writer. He worked with Chappelle on Chappelle's show, but we wrote a sketch that was in the show that week that was about the election results coming in and people watching and sort of a time lapse of how the night went as the results came in. And we wrote that essentially in response to what was happening in real time in our office that night before, because, you know, the discussions were, you know, it was sort of like early joking around, like, uh-oh, Hillary didn't win Alabama. I bet, watch out. And then it got to like, wait, she's going to lose Michigan? It was like, it was that kind of thing. And it was perfect for Dave and Chris Rock, who came in and did it too later in the week, because they were not surprised. They were like, yeah, of course, this is how America's going to go. And it was, they could play that attitude in the sketch, and it kind of reflected what was actually, what we were all actually figuring out in real time that night. And I think when we read it at the table on Wednesday, which is the day after the election, obviously, when we read it at the table read, it didn't even necessarily play that hot, because people were also kind of, it was very raw. So no one really wanted to relive what had just happened the night before in sketch form. But then by Saturday, I think people were ready to at least laugh about it, even if it was in a cathartic way. And I think they were, that was another one where like Dave and Chris were perfect for that kind of, to come in and have that perspective.
It's very helpful to have a veteran or legendary comedian like Dave, where you kind of, you know, I think one of the things that years in comedy gets you is trust. And people understand how honest you are. And I think it's a little bit more, it makes people more comfortable when they know that you're about to speak. And it's something that we all write toward, and hopefully someday we will create that kind of relationship with the audience. So coming from other comedians, it might have even been a really, really tough plane to land. But Dave being who he is, and people understanding how measured Dave is, that he, as a voice and as a role model, I think, coming from him, it worked perfectly, because I think people believed it. People said, "Yeah, I could see that there are people, black people and people of color that seen this happen and was probably like, yep, America's right on time with this one." You know, I think that was kind of the tone that he was trying to. That was kind of the point. And it was kind of cool to watch, because, not like I said, not a lot of shows can get away with that. And not a lot of comedians can get away with that. And so that's what makes our show special.
So what is the job of head writer?
Great question. I mean, we would love someone to explain it to us.
Yeah, it's a great title. People think when they hear head writer, they think, oh, that's the guy that writes everything and delegates. But it's really not. It's really more of kind of a supervisor role. But we're competing to get stuff on just like any other writer. You know, there's no, you don't walk around in a with a big old cigar or anything like that. it's not like the brochure.
No, it's very, and very often usually the writers that are, there's writers that are getting the most on that aren't the head writer, because sometimes as a head writer you're stuck in meetings for a while, or you're talking to the host in a different way, or you're more hearing ideas than you are getting to write your own. So you still definitely contribute as a writer. And part of it, I think, is sort of trying to lead by example and just write things you think are funny. And then the other part of it is trying as much as you can to help newer writers if they have an idea that you think could be really funny and they're new, so they might not totally know the structure of it or how to cast it or that kind of thing, just to help them with that, because that's what happened to us when we were new. People who are more senior, you know, really looked out and tried to make what we wrote better, because otherwise it's hard to get things on when you're new.
Also, you're more so than any other writers, you're thinking of the entire body of the show. Like, you're thinking of the cold open, you're thinking of the monologue, you're thinking of the first sketch out of monologue, you're thinking of, you know, what would be interesting, what bumps and things like that. Is as a head writer, you kind of have to consider more of the show as a whole, as opposed to when you're a writer, you're just thinking about your piece and if you have a tag for somebody else's thing or whatever. But as a head writer, you kind of have to think about the entire show more so than
in the beginning. The first part is usually the part that's figured out last, which is what makes that job stressful.
Right, because the news cycle is so quick now that what seems relevant Monday probably won't by Saturday.
Yeah. You know, Lauren always talks about how the first 15 minutes of the show are the most important, because that's when you're, if you're tuning in, that's your real chance to hook a viewer.
Right.
The monologue is such a tricky thing always, because you want to show off who this person is, maybe in a way you haven't seen them before. And that's a thing we often have to at least help figure out. And then the cold open is such a different animal, and that's constantly shifting. And the number of weeks where the cold open and the monologue are both even vaguely figured out before Thursday, it almost never happens. If it does, you just cross your fingers that those will hold up by Saturday, because those are feels like a luxury.
The cold open is usually where the political sketch is. And if, like, Alec Baldwin is doing Trump, that's where it is. And usually, like, if Kate McKinnon is doing Jeff Sessions, that's where it's going to be. So I can see why that would be kind of last minute. And speaking of Alec Baldwin, like, do you know if he's coming back?
We truly didn't. Someone said to us the other day, oh, you're coming back as head writers. And we truly, no one ever told us. So we do not know. We try to just try to figure out what we're doing and on our own, and then we wait and see. But you know,
it's kind of like being on like a playoff team. Like sometimes you might get 40 minutes, sometimes you get 10 minutes. You know, sometimes you're starting, sometimes certain combinations work. So you never really know. It's more so about how do we execute the best show. So it's a weird place of it's always in the moment. So it's kind of hard to answer that.
There's times you don't learn about a new credit or something you're getting until someone in your family sees it in the scroll at the end of the show, and you're like, oh, I guess that kicked in this week.
Did that happen to you?
I didn't know I didn't know I was a writer on the show until like 3 weeks after I was a writer on the show.
What do you mean?
Well, remember Seth was like, you know, you're hired for the season. And I had no idea. I thought I was still, because I came in on a guest contract. Yeah. So I was like week to week. And I was working there for about 2 weeks. Like I was already there. And they were like, you know, you're hired, right? Like you work here. Seth, who was head writer at the time. I had no clue. No one told me. This was in the middle of a production week.
It's not always a great communication place.
No,
But in part of that is, it's really just the velocity of the show. Sometimes there's so many moving pieces that not everyone is told everything all the time. And the reality is we would basically be doing a similar job regardless of what our title was.
Like right.
When we were at it as head writers with Kent and Brian Chris and Sarah had been head writers too, like you're doing effectively the same job. You're in most of the same meetings because we've been there for a while, and you would do the same hard work, and you would care in the same way about the show, regardless of what your title is.
My guests are Colin Jost and Michael Che, anchors of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. They're also head writers on the show. They're hosting the Emmys Monday night. Here's a clip of Che on Update from last season's finale.
A report has found that 86% of people arrested in New York for marijuana possession are black or Latino. Well, duh, we're the only ones they search. That's like saying the only people that have STDs are the people that take tests for STDs. We're not the only ones that carry drugs. If cops search white dudes in cargo shorts as much as they search black dudes in hoodies, prison would look like a Dave Matthews concert. Talking about needing diversity in Hollywood. You know what we really need diversity? Jail. Forget about Oscars so white. How about prisons is too black? Colin.
We'll hear a clip from Colin Jost on Update after a break, and we'll talk more with Colin Jost and Michael Che. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Colin Jost and Michael Che, the anchors of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. They're preparing for the new season, which starts September 29th. They're also preparing to host the Emmys Monday night. They're nominated, along with SNL's other writers, for Best Writing for a Variety Series. Last January, they became head writers of SNL. Jost had held that position before, but gave it up after becoming an Update anchor. We just heard an excerpt of Che on Update. Here's Jost from last February after President Trump's first State of the Union address and Trump's tweets about it.
President Trump also tweeted that he had the highest ratings ever for a State of the Union address, which, get this, wasn't true. And this time, even Fox News fact-checked on him. You know you're running your mouth too much when even your hype man is like, yo, that ain't exactly accurate, though. So far.
That was good.
Oh, thank you. Then, in a new interview, President Trump stated that he is not a feminist. Was he getting accused of that a lot?
Michael Che, one of the things that you've said that's controversial is you were talking about Louis C.K. doing a set, you know, kind of testing out new material, showing up as a surprise to the audience. And there were a lot of complaints, like, the public isn't ready to see Louis C.K. yet. And you tweeted that, you know, he should be able, well, it wasn't tweeted, it was on your Instagram. You said, a lot of what I read says that C.K. shouldn't get to be a famous comedian anymore because to them he's still winning. Isn't that strange? Meaning he can be shamed, humiliated, lose millions of dollars, lose all of his projects, lose the respect of a lot of his fans and peers and whatever else that comes with what he did. But since he can still do a comedy set for free at a 200-seat club a year later, it means he got off easy. That's how coveted fame is. After the response you got to that, a lot of negative responses to that, how do you feel about what you said?
I think it was extremely ill-timed. I mean, the thing about when you write anything, you kind of surrender the context and you kind of surrender the way it will be presented to people and how people will, the tone it will take, you know? So I think if you could cleverly make that to seem like a terrible thing, and you can make it seem like what it was, which was just me saying, I just think it's interesting what the power of fame and what the power of stage, how it's perceived, you know? I just think it's extremely interesting. That was like something that was kind of selfishly a thing that came to my head immediately when I read those stories.
What do you mean selfishly? Mean because you're famous?
Well, selfishly because I work in this business, and you realize that you're extremely lucky to, and people are very, very, it's a privilege, you know, it really is a privilege to be able to work. It's a privilege to be able to do this and have a job that you really, really care about, mm-hmm. and that people love and respect, and they will take it away from you, you know, whether you like, they will take it away from you. And they remind you like, hey, you know, we will take this away from you. And I think that was what I was talking about. I wasn't really even talking about Louis necessarily. I was using him as an example because it was something that reminded me of, wow, this is kind of a special thing that we get to do. And he could go through whatever he went through, which seems scary as hell, deserved, and people will still say, well, you still get to do this thing, and that bothers me.
I think
them saying it, not me, obviously.
I think what's bothering a lot of women is that if he doesn't seem to have done anything as of yet to change. He said he's going to spend a lot of time just like listening and thinking.
Yeah.
And if there's evidence that he's changed, he hasn't presented it yet. And I think that was what was bothering a lot of people. Like, he's back on stage, but like, what's different? What's changed?
None. You know what? And it's so crazy because I was just talking about this with somebody, but that's kind of, I don't disagree with any of that. Like, I truly think him going on stage and not addressing anything was insane, you know? And I don't fault the attempt of making it right. I do fault the execution of not making it right, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
Like I think everybody has the right to defend themselves. Everybody has the right to take the opportunity to clarify or apologize or make any bad situation right. But when you don't do it, it's indefensible. You know, like what can you say? And I think that he missed a big opportunity to make that right.
So is this, Michael Che, is this one of the reasons why you're not on Twitter anymore? What we were talking about was Instagram, but still, is this...
I don't like Twitter because It's no one's as angry as they say they are, or no one's as happy as they say they are. It's just kind of this land of hyperbole that I have a platform. Like, we go on TV and we're lucky enough to be able to tweet to a camera and speak. So it's not for me. I just don't like it. I don't like the way it makes people feel. I don't like the way it makes people gang up on other people, justly or not. It's just uncomfortable. I don't like it at all. It's just a cesspool of everybody just yelling at each other, and the anger and anger and like and I don't know what the opposite of anger is, but I've never experienced it. But anger and the opposite.
Peace, joy, yeah, I don't know.
Anger and extreme joy are the only voices that get heard on Twitter, you know.
Well, one thing I have to say is that if you're following terrific journalists on Twitter, you get the news really quickly. You get links to great articles quick. Like, that's a terrific function that Twitter serves.
Well, It also used to have a great function because you'd follow comedians or your friends who were really funny, and every time you'd go on, you'd see like a great joke.
Everybody was scared to death on there, man.
Yeah,
I don't know, Dad. We have to talk about this more. I'm gonna get you off Twitter. It doesn't make sense. It really doesn't.
I don't tweet. I just read good journalists. And
yeah, you know why? And why don't you tweet?
Yeah.
And why don't you tweet? Because if you say one thing just in the heat of,
you know why? Because
yes,
there's several reasons. One is I would be writing a tweet, and then I'd be thinking, let me sleep on that and then edit it in the morning. And
right.
Like, that's not the spirit of Twitter. And I don't have the time. I spend so much time working on the show.
Right.
Tweeting would just be another assignment. It would just be more work. So I like reading journalists. I like reading comics, but I don't want to tweet.
You're 100, and I totally agree with you. It's like you have to think of it as if this has to be able to stand up when I don't have control of it anymore. This statement, it's in black and white.
It's a full press
statement. It's a press release. You're just doing mini press releases on something that you thought about for 30 seconds. But the crazy part is it lulls you into thinking, oh, this is just an interaction. This is a casual conversation.
Yeah.
And the next thing you know, you're held to that forever. Like, if you said this one thing, that means that's what you believe. 10 years from now, if you want to run for president, but wait a minute, you believe this thing because you said it in 2009, and people don't want to hear anything else. Huh. It's insane. People base articles on this. They base what jobs you should be able to have based on something you said flippantly in a conversation, getting the news as it was happening.
It's just
an insane responsibility.
Having Twitter on your phone is like being with a journalist that hates you 24 hours a day.
Yeah, seriously.
Anything you say that's what you have to think of it as.
Yeah, it's like walking around with the district attorney. And everything you say is just going to the district attorney. And you're like, why
you
am I doing
very
this?
Strong feelings about this. So it was very controversial when Saturday Night Live had candidate Trump, guest hosting the show. And you were doing Update back then.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about that a little bit the last time you were on. But
right.
And there were protests and everything that you were having him on.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have President Trump on the show?
I mean, to me, I don't mind anybody being on this show because I think something good can come out of anything in comedy, you know? But I wouldn't go for it. I mean, I don't know what the win is. I don't think people find him funny.
What was it like to work with him before he became president?
It was like working with any unfunny, insecure dude, you know? Just like a... You know, that's another thing. Like, when you see him as a human, and then he's in this kind of larger-than-life chair, it kind of, I don't know.
Michael, you said that when Trump was on the show during his candidacy, that he seemed insecure. What made him seem that way?
Well, most people are insecure when they come on our show just because it's a scary thing to do. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's very hard
mm-hmm.
to be on live TV.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to be around so much, a very talented cast that's used to it, and you kind of got to keep up with them, and the speed of the show is very intimidating. And I think it humanizes a lot of people. It humanizes most people that host the show. So, and also, you always think you're funny until you're in front of an audience, you know, especially an audience that's not necessarily your audience.
But did he do particular things that made him seem insecure?
There's always a code of, we know how hard the job is, so, you know, it's almost doctor-patient privilege when you host
sure.
a show.
It's that, HIPAA? Sure.
Yeah. it's kind of that, where we don't kind of, you know, spill everybody's tea, as the kids say.
So I want to ask you about the Mother's Day show, when each cast member's mother comes out and talks about their child, who's the cast member, except for Michael Che's mother. So on Update, Melissa McCarthy, playing your stepmother, comes out wearing this, like, pink T-shirt that says, like, world's proudest stepmother on it, or stepmom. And so I hope it's not putting you too much on the spot to ask, how come your mother wasn't there?
My mother doesn't really like cameras. She doesn't even like still photos. So it's kind of hard to get her to sign up for live TV. And it's, to me, it's mind-boggling with anybody. Just, I know how nerve-wracking it is for us as professionals to be up there on home base. But for someone that's not even a professional comedian to be like, sure, I'll do that for Mother's Day and try to land a joke, it's kind of cool to see. And it was a lot of great moments. But my mother just doesn't like really like TV and cameras. But turns out Melissa McCarthy is a much better comedian than my mother. That's what I'm trying to say. Who knew?
Would you describe the sketch, because it's too visual to just like play the audio?
Melissa McCarthy comes out as my mother on Update, and she's very, very, very motherly. She's wiping crust off my face, and she's a little bit smothering, and she's extremely supportive. And it's a little annoying, but also it's my mom. So it's pretty close to my actual relationship with my mother, probably.
Seriously?
If I could brag about Michael's acting in it, I thought he was especially good playing off opposite Melissa. And I thought he played it in a very real way that you would want to try to keep on the positive side of it, but while also being annoyed by
it. I'm not gonna let anybody give me credit for that. It's Melissa McCarthy flying, so you just sit. It's like everything's better with bacon. Everybody's funnier with Melissa McCarthy doing the heavy lifting, so I'm just sitting there watching most of the time.
So I think it's interesting how comedy is changing, in the sense that, like, there were so many comics for so many years, and maybe there still is, at comedy clubs telling, like, sexist jokes about sex and about women. And I hope that it's more difficult to do that now.
Well, I think it's hard to... Being in comedy is kind of hard, because, like, I'm exposed to so much comedy, and mm-hmm, most mm-hmm. of the country and most of the world knows maybe 5 to 10 stand-up comedians. So, and they base all of stand-up, of the thousands of stand-up, they base everything based on, you know, who's popular at the time. And it's usually only 5 or 10 guys that are extremely popular and cross over mainstream. But as somebody that works in comedy, I think for years, and even studying comedy as a kid, like, this is always going to be jokes that was funny 20 years ago that won't be acceptable years later. I mean, as a black person, you know, there's stuff that doesn't fly, you know what I mean? That mm-hmm, would have, you know, mm-hmm. There used to be comedians that came out in blackface that was white, you know, like, that's completely not acceptable anymore. And I think that's always going to be the case. More people, especially now that media is so much bigger and more people have voices, they can say, look, even with the Louis situation, like, yeah, Louis can go out there, but also people have the right to come out and say, you know what, we don't want to see, and we don't want to support anybody that supports him, and that's your right too. And I think that's, you know, that's something as a performer you have to deal with. People can reject you just the way you can comment on everybody, they can comment on you, and that's the way it is, you know. You kind of got to take what you get from that.
So, and there's two elements to anything like that. Is one, is it how does it fly among your peers? You know, if someone's a comedian and they're doing jokes like that now, it's not even your peers. Your peers would probably just be like, why? Like, what? That doesn't seem like, well, I mean, they might not even say that to you. They might just not really want to hang out with you or really think that that was a great, whatever, you know, that's part of it. And then the other is just audience.
So I think I need to let you go and get back to preparing for the Emmys. Just a question, are you nervous?
No.
I was going to say yes.
No, it's not, you can't be nervous. It's just, it's comedy. It's like literally comedy. Even if it's bad, that's pretty funny too. Worst case scenario, it's terrible and it's funny that it's so bad. So it's, you know, it's nothing to be afraid of. Nobody, like, this isn't a real job, man, you know?
That's a good idea.
If I was a fireman, firemen should be afraid.
I'd be very nervous.
Brain surgeons. But, like, for comedy, we're literally going out there and we're just going to tell some jokes and people are going to like them or not. But it's nothing to be afraid of.
Colin, you have firemen in your family.
Do you see it
that way, too? That, like, fire is something to be afraid of. Doing comedy isn't worth getting really worried about because it's just comedy?
Certainly, fire is a lot scarier. Yeah, as the first basically non-hero in my family, I get nervous because I'm more nervous leading
because you
up
have higher standards than Michael Che has.
Exactly.
I don't have high standards at all, man. This is back of the classroom humor. I'm throwing spitballs at everybody. I could care less, you know. What's there to be afraid of?
I get nervous more when it's not in front of me. When I'm thinking about it in advance, that's more nerve-wracking than when you're actually out on stage and you're feeling, then you know what it's like to be on stage, and then that feels a lot more liberating. It's more the lead up to it where, I don't know, you having not actually gone through it before, where that's more nerve-wracking for me. But I would still take it over fires.
Good luck to both of you. Thank you so much for coming back on our show. I really enjoyed it. And
thank you for having us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good luck on Monday. Colin Jost and Michael Che are the anchors of SNL's Weekend Update and are head writers on the show. Monday night, they'll host the Emmys, which will be broadcast on NBC. After we take a short break, David Bianculli will review the new Hulu drama series, The First, starring Sean Penn. This is Fresh Air.